new board of directors was filed with the Federal Communications Commission. Officers and directors of the old board were Paula Small, Michael Papadopoulos, Hadrian Machiche, S.W. Conser, Mark Brown, Lynn Mollick, Lisa Loving, Jeff Kippelman, John Mackey, Damon Isaiah Turner, Matthew Bristow, and Rabia Yaman. Officers and directors of the new board are Matthew Bristow, Adine Rogovin, Mark Sherman, Susan Bartlett, Joe Uris, Jennifer Davis, Michael Wells, Lynn Mollick, S.W. Conser, Michael Papadopoulos, Timothy Welp, and Jeff Kippelman. A copy of the application and related materials are available for public inspection at KBOO's main studio at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, between the hours of 9 a.m. and 5 p.m., Monday through Friday.
KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present The Yes Men Fix the World. Thursday, November 14th at 7 p.m., KBOO will be showing the 2009 indie classic film, The Yes Men Fix the World. The Yes Men Fix the World is the true story of two political activists posing as executives of giant corporations. In their thrift store suits, they lie their way into big business conferences and pull off pranks. That's The Yes Men Fix the World, November 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/yesmen2013.
The time is 5:02. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, which has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, the Clinton Street Theater featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Mayor Hales strikes out at citizen efforts to create an independent water district in Portland.
In contract negotiations, Boeing threatens to move union jobs outside of Washington State.
Arrests have been made in California after a massive protest held by workers for Walmart.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 8th, 2013. I'm Ren Green.
And I'm Liam Delta. The City Council of Enterprise is operating a water system that is out of compliance with state health standards. A federal loan for $5.7 million has already been secured to fund a project to update the system. Key improvements include increasing customer water pressure in order to meet required standards, increasing the number of fire hydrants, repairing the underground concrete reservoir, and increasing total water storage. The city's currently at insufficient capacity to supply water that could be required for emergency firefighting purposes. Enterprise's council has chosen the plan with the second lowest impact to the rates of water consumers. A public meeting will be held Wednesday to clarify the city's overall plans for improvement.
Signature gatherers for the initiative to create an independent water district in Portland announced today that they have reached the halfway point in their efforts and are on track to exceed the required 30,000 signatures. This effort by Portland ratepayers has prompted an angry response from Mayor Hales, who called it an act of political terrorism. For more, KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with co-chief petitioner and longtime water activist Floyd Jones.
For years, the Portland Water Bureau has been a favorite honeypot for City Hall politicians, with your water bills funding disparate projects unrelated to water delivery. Now, citizens fed up with continual rate increases and lack of transparency at the Bureau are circulating a petition which would put the creation of an independent water district on the ballot. Here's Floyd Jones, longtime leader of Friends of the Reservoirs and co-chief petitioner of the ballot initiative.
The Portland Public Water District, we've reached a milestone. We've collected over 15,000 signatures, so that puts us to the halfway point. We are going to exceed collecting 30,000 signatures before we turn them in, but we're making really good progress.
City Hall is displeased by this effort.
Well, indeed they are. The bottom line is, I'm sure Hales is saying, how dare you take away my erector set? I mean, you know, the city council, past city councils have used our water resources, BES resources, for a long list of projects that really have nothing to do with the mission of those utilities. And then there is, of course, the license, utility license fee. And every time they raise your rates, whether it's 17.9%, 12.6%, whatever, they collect more money out of that utility license fee. So loss of piggy bank is a big threat.
Another thing Hale said was that corporations now can escape Superfund liability. What?
And he provides no explanation for that, does he? Because how is it that this initiative would have any impact on that whatsoever? Those processes are already fully developed, and this initiative is going to have no impact on whether polluters pay or don't pay.
Some environmental groups are also coming out against it. They're worried about an obscure board with less transparency and less accountability.
Well, PUDs, this is an official PUD, but they function well across the nation, and I don't think Portlanders are going to allow this board to be obscure by any means. And one of the reasons we've been pushing for this, and Friends of the Reservoirs actually had initiatives nearly 10 years ago to create a water board, is because of the lack of transparency at City Hall. City Hall is known, I mean, Augsburg rated City Hall very poorly in terms of their disclosure of finances, and the Water Bureau is one of the worst. On November 20th, I'll attend my 61st Water Bureau budget meeting, and it is like pulling teeth to get financial information out of them. The most significant information we learn is not the information they hand us, but it's the information that they withhold.
Some people are also worried about heavy support from industry for this initiative.
Well, 10 years ago, when we had these initiatives, we were knocking on doors and collecting signatures. Everyone signs, but you're not going to get anything on the ballot unless you have broad-based community support. And large water users, they pay the same rate as everyone else. And so when these water rates go up 160% since 2000, it's really hard for these businesses to keep operating in Portland. And so they, too, are interested in affordable water rates. And so, frankly, we're grateful to have their support. I mean, they've come out to council many times with us when we were fighting a chemical filtration plant and burial of the reservoirs. They've been there. They hired an attorney to help us on the reservoir issue. So we're grateful for their support, and we think they should be able to stay in Portland and have affordable rates.
Will this initiative save Mount Tabor Reservoir and our other open reservoirs?
Well, it depends on how quickly the Water Bureau works to, thwart community interests. They violated a city council ordinance in fast-tracking these projects to start with. The 2004 ordinance required that they gather together community stakeholders before they took any action, and they went ahead and put together a fast-track plan without community involvement. And now they're working to get their projects done even faster, while Rochester, New York, and New York City have sincerely worked for their constituents and have delays, and the rule is under revision. But this initiative definitely could help if the Water Bureau hasn't already disconnected the Mount Tabor reservoirs.
Anything else for our listeners on this important initiative?
Well, we'd ask that people come out and support the initiative. Our office is just off 28th and Sandy, so sign the petition, volunteer, and go to our website, waterreform.org.
That was co-chief petitioner Floyd Jones. She told us that Hales is angry over the possibility of losing his erector set. And I'm Joe Meyer with KABU News.
A public works project completed 2 years ago was put to test again yesterday during Portland's torrential downpour. Heavy rain all used to pose a threat to our local sewage system. This would have driven the system past capacity, pushing raw sewage into the Willamette and Columbia Rivers. September's rain of more than 3 inches in one day proved too much for the system. Yesterday, however, the large tunnels that channel water to a pump station on Swan Island did successfully carry the rainwater to the treatment plant in North Portland. Sewage spills occurred in some capacity approximately 50 times a year before the big pipe project was completed. The upgrade has reduced this number to only 6 such accidents in the last 2 years.
This weekend marks the first anniversary of Idle No More, an Indigenous rights group based in Canada that has made headlines opposing fracking and other harmful practices on Native territories. Sylvia McAdam, one of the founders of Idle No More, spoke with KABU reporter Keegan Heron on their accomplishments and the year ahead for the burgeoning movement.
In a broad sense, I was wondering if you could give our listeners some of the major events that are planned for this weekend.
There will be peaceful, celebratory events all over, reviewing the year's events and our successes. I think we've done an incredible, incredible defending of our human rights in terms of land and water and Indigenous sovereignty. I think people forget that the treaties that are the foundation of the United States and Canada embed the human rights of Indigenous people. And we should all celebrate, because the awakening of the consciousness and the restoring of Turtle Island is involving Indigenous people in a powerful and peaceful way.
Can you give a couple specific successes that Idle No More has had?
Quebec has banned fracking. And then there's the Keystone Pipeline in British Columbia. There's still the ongoing resistance of that pipeline to go through.
Also, what groups have been strong coalition partners with Idle No More?
Our partners are Defenders of the Land. We've created an alliance with them. And also, we are in dialogue with LEAD Now. And there's another group called ShitHarperDid.com. And then we also have Kairos, Council of Canadians. And now, from last night, we're in dialogue with 1 Billion Rising, founded by Eve Ensler.
New Brunswick recently gave the go-ahead for fracking explorations on Native lands, whereas Newfoundland recently banned any fracking. Do you know how have Idle No More protesters in that region responded to those announcements?
The Idle No More supporters and their allies have stated they will continue to have a peaceful resistance, and they will continue to make their stand.
How has the Canadian government responded to Idle No More this past year?
I think they don't know what to make of Idle No More, because we don't have a leader per se. We have organizers that organize resistances all over the place, even into the U.S. But we are educating people. They're better able as communities, as nations, to defend themselves with these corporations going into their lands and saying, this is good for you economically. That's a short-term goal. In the long term, the land and the water will be devastated. And that's the information they have a right to know.
What are some steps that Idle No More is going to take in the next year to further their accomplishments?
Well, we have another global event happening on December 10th. And I invite people to check out our website for all kinds of events and to create an event and be part of the revolution that is peaceful.
I've been talking with Sylvia McAdam of Idle No More. This is Keegan Heron with KABU News.
54 employees of the Walmart Corporation were arrested yesterday in Los Angeles on charges of civil disobedience. Workers at a downtown Los Angeles Walmart store organized a protest that has been called the largest ever by workers at the company. Protesters acted after a year of continued strikes against unfair wage, poor working conditions, and retaliation against employees speaking out against the corporation. 100 police officers with full riot gear and a helicopter were called in to arrest the protesters after they sat in the street outside a Walmart store. Here's a recording from last night's protest.
They make under $20,000, if not less. They have to go to food banks to survive, and they have to go with government assistance.
Is that they rehire and bring back the people that they've wrongfully let go. They've broken the law several times in doing these things. Also, Walmart has made several promises to communities that they will pay Walmart workers $12 or $13 an hour. So I'd like to see Walmart not only bring those workers back, but to, you know, live up to their promises.
Our Walmart, an organization created to protect workers at the retail giant, have arranged nationwide strikes throughout the holiday season. This includes a strike scheduled for the infamous shopping day after Thanksgiving, Black Friday.
The Oregon-based air carrier Evergreen Aviation has announced that it will cease operations at the end of this month. The company has come under fire this year for potentially illegal transfers of money between its nonprofit and for-profit wings. The shutdown of the aviation company will not impact its theme park and museum based in McMinnville. Evergreen has had contracts with the U.S. military and commercial firms for air cargo transfer. Some have accused Evergreen of involvement in rendition flights of terrorist suspects for the CIA, but those accusations were never proven.
Today, Boeing threatened to build its latest jet outside Washington State if their union workers do not ratify a proposed contract extension by next week. Boeing's warning came in response to the local aerospace union president, Tom Rabluski, who tore up a copy of the proposed contract at a union meeting yesterday. Aerospace union members are not happy with limits the contract places on pay raises to 1% every other year. Washington Governor Jay Inslee called the state legislature into a special session yesterday to consider extending tax incentives for aerospace manufacturing all the way to 2040 rather than 2024. Boeing said in a statement today that an extension of the tax incentives for aerospace plants will be a crucial factor in its decision over where to locate the work on the 777X. One possible location for Boeing to shift work on the jet to is a non-unionized assembly line in Charleston, South Carolina, already used to construct 787 Dreamliners. As a way to encourage union members to support the 8-year contract extension, Boeing has offered $10,000 signing bonuses and no reduction in benefits for workers as young as 58 who take early retirement.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast, followed by Hard Knock Radio at 7, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be cloudy with a high temperature near 52 degrees and light winds, a 20% chance of rain after 10 a.m. Tonight's weather is expected to be mostly cloudy with a low around 45 degrees. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are: in Beaverton, it's 38 CPM with a high of 52. Raleigh Hills, 29 CPM with a high of 45. Damascus, Oregon has a count of 32 CPM with a high of 49. Powell Butte measures 25 CPM with a high of 42. Seaside, Oregon has 33 CPM with a high of 54. Seattle, Washington measured 30 CPM, high 44. Hanford, Washington has 37 CPM, high of 44. And Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 35 per minute with spikes up to 49. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:20. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Goldman Sachs churns out enormous profits from its high-rolling casino investment schemes while also churning out fat paychecks for its top executives. They literally sack up the gold, even as their speculative gambles have wreaked havoc on our real economy. But finally recognizing that their public approval rating has sunk lower than mad cow disease, Goldman's banking barons now want you to know that they feel your pain and are eager to give back to the people. So, ta-da! They've goosed up the Goldman Sachs Foundation in order to flash their charitable side. The bank's chief of staff noted that people said we weren't doing enough to address the gross inequities created by Wall Streeters like him. So they've turned their foundation into the fourth largest corporate charity in America. It doled out $241 million last year, including grants to women in developing nations and small business projects here. That sum would be impressive, except for two little hickeys on it. First, the foundation spends an unseemly amount on slick videos and PR efforts to extol Goldman's new generosity, diverting the charity from altruism to corporate promotion. One Goldman banker, who's appalled at the self-promotion, said of the charity, "It's run as if it's a Broadway show." Second, $241 million sounds like a lot until you see that the financial empire's income last year topped $34 billion. Do the math, and it turns out that these bankers with a heart of gold actually allocated an underwhelming 0.7% of Goldman's income to its widely ballyhooed beneficence. This is Jim Hightower saying, how pathetic. Even poor people put these multimillionaires to shame, regularly donating 3.2% of their meager incomes to charity. Trying to buy redemption on the cheap is just another Wall Street scam.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
On Friday, today, Secretary of State John Kerry cut a Middle East trip short to lead a diplomatic push to work out a deal with Iran. The deal would temporarily freeze at least some of Iran's nuclear activities in return for unspecified but limited relief from painful economic sanctions. Iranian officials have effusively praised what they call progress in their negotiations with the U.S. and the European Union. U.S. officials have described the deal as an opening move that would halt the progress in Iran's nuclear program and relax some economic sanctions for perhaps 6 months to give negotiators time to forge a more comprehensive agreement. For more on this, we have audio from Feature Story News.
I think that they have an agreement on the larger framework, but then there's going to be initial steps in which I think there's a desire from both sides to make sure that they're not giving too much in the early phases of this deal so that they have less leverage when it comes to the second and perhaps third phase of the deal. There's a bargaining that is taking place right now, which is typical towards the end of a negotiation. I think, however, when it comes to the broader parameters of the deal, there is an agreement. I don't think we would have seen Secretary Kerry, and certainly not Foreign Minister Lavrov from Russia, go to Geneva. He's going to arrive there tomorrow, according to the news. I don't think we would have seen that unless they had come very, very close to a deal.
Do you think that deal includes the ability to monitor consistently the two major uranium enrichment plants in Iran?
Well, the two sites that are there are already being monitored. In fact, they're the two most monitored sites that the IAEA is dealing with. What we need, however, is further monitoring of having the additional protocol ratified and implemented by the Iranian that gives the IAEA the opportunity to go and do spot checks on undeclared sites. That's the best instrument we have to make sure that there isn't a secret program.
The Israelis are highly skeptical. They think the international community is being duped by this.
I don't think the international community is being duped, and I think, to be completely frank, that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not being entirely honest. He is doing what he has to do from his political perspective. I think he knows very well he's not going to change the parameters of the deal. I think he also knows by now that he's not going to be able to scuttle it. And he also knows that this actually is a good deal. It's a good deal for Israel, because if there is an improvement of relations between the United States and Iran, inevitably, that will also lead to the Iranians softening their position on Israel. And that is good for Israel.
We know that there's been a domestically in Iran, a rearrangement of the political emphasis on engagement with the US and the international community. Has there been an equal and opposite engagement of a different kind, a sea change in Washington?
I think the president has been leading an effort to get that type of a sea change. I would have to say that I follow this issue very closely. I've written a book about what Obama has done on Iran. And I've never seen the president and his entire administration being so dedicated, so committed to a deal, to a negotiation process, and be willing to take the heat from Israel, from Congress, from Saudi Arabia, in order to get what they know is a very good deal.
Could this impact the proxy war that's happening in Syria, or will all that complexity still be in the pot?
The complexity will be there, but there will be new opportunities to actually address it effectively. At the end of the day, you cannot have a deal, a sustainable deal in Syria, without having the Iranians and having the Saudis involved. I think opportunities will open up.
After meeting with Kerry in Israel today, Prime Minister Netanyahu delivered a blistering statement that accused the United States of rushing into what he called a bad deal with Iran.
U.S. troops suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of sexual trauma are less likely to receive benefits, according to a study released yesterday. The report comes from the ACLU and the Service Women's Action Network. It could point to discrimination against service members who have survived sexual assaults. The report notes that barriers to reporting and prosecuting sexual crimes in the armed forces could explain the discrepancy. The report does not include information from 2013, but data recently released from the Pentagon shows a 46% increase in reported military sexual assaults over the past fiscal year. On Wednesday, the Center for American Progress released their own report, warning that those numbers may still be heavily underreported due to lack of data from service academies and other systemic problems.
Typhoon Haiyan struck the Philippine city of Samar at 4:30 this morning and is now believed to be the strongest Pacific storm on record. Three people have been killed, and more than 120,000 people have been displaced from their homes. The typhoon has generated winds approaching 200 miles per hour. Floodwaters resulting from 15-foot storm-generated waves raise concerns that the death toll will increase as relief efforts reach affected areas. The storm has now crossed the Philippines and is set on a course for Vietnam, Laos, and China's mainland as it passes through the South China Sea. KBOO reporter Ross Freeman-Levin spoke with a Portland State University professor to find out more about the storm, its possible causes, and its effects.
Scientists have predicted the relationship between rising sea surface temperature, which is produced by increasing greenhouse gases created by human activities, and whether that is associated with the intensity of those tropical cyclones, hurricanes or typhoons, the same type of phenomena. And they do see some strong correlation between the two. So as you increase the sea surface temperature, you're going to have a more stronger and intense storms. But the thing is, whether the number of storms have increased over the years, that is still kind of mystery. So some models do predict we're going to have much stronger storms, but with a fewer big intense storms. But the relationship between increasing sea surface temperature and the intensity of those storms looks pretty well established.
Is the rise in sea surface temperatures expected to continue on its current trend upwards?
So there is a feedback between as the atmosphere temperature rises, So, and the sea surface, so does the sea surface temperature. And most cases, it's an expansion of the sea surface, and also it creates some sea level rise, and then it's going to have much stronger storms on those coastal areas as water temperature rises.
Is there any recommended course of action that scientists are making to either stem the rise in sea surface temperatures, or if there isn't any recommended action that could forestall that rise, is there anything that people are being encouraged to do to reduce their impact on sea surface temperatures?
So the impacts might be very regional specific. So in terms of potential adaptation or mitigation strategies, so we can probably prepare for those strategies by locally or regionally. When you talk about combating the climate change, we can think about both climate mitigation and adaptation. So you have to control the source of those greenhouse gases. That's what the mitigation is about. But at the same time, if things are changing because the climate system has inertia, so what we did in the previous decade may still affecting what's going on now. So we need to prepare for that adaptation. So we have to do those two different strategies together. For example, in some coastal communities, they may be vulnerable to those coastal disasters and tropical storms. So we can create more kind of wetlands by changing our land zoning or land use planning. So when you talk about the climate change adaptation, we should tie that back to more land use planning, spatial planning. That's why the locals can actually act and prepare for those climate change.
This has been Ross Freeman Levin for KBOO News. I've been speaking with Heejun Chang, Portland State University professor of geography with an expertise in hydroclimatology. Professor Chang, thank you very much for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
Laura Logan with CBS News has issued an apology for the inaccurate report on 60 Minutes that threw into question the Obama administration's response to the attack on the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi, Libya. The report aired on October 27th. The main source used was a security contractor who has been proven to be a fraud. Following the 60 Minutes program, congressional Republicans used